This is a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
You're tuned in to the R1 News, your stop for news and current affairs on the airwaves. 11 to 12 weekdays here on Radio 1 91 FM. Te reo iridangi kotahi.
Tēnā koutou I tēnei ata. This is the R1 News here on Radio 1. Ko Seb Aho.
Ko Nico Aho, and we'll be taking you through the news here on Ratu, 7th of June. Coming up on the show, I tēnei rā, we have Eileen with the news headlines and weather. Following on from that, we have a live interview talking with Dunedin City of Literature director Nikki Page about a book she has compiled containing international creative writing on the climate crisis called The Heat Is On.
After this, we'll be joined live by Andrea Midgen, the chief executive of the SPCA, to talk about the latest budget announcement, which included a decision not to increase funds to the Animal Welfare Association.
Then following on from that, we'll be playing out a pre-recorded interview I had with Ahi, the National Coordinator for Gender Minorities Aotearoa, on the government's budget for healthcare services for intersex youth and transgender community.
And to wrap up, we'll be speaking with Andy live on this week's Creature of the Week, where we are talking bees. But before all that, here is today's news headlines and weather with Eileen.
The R1 News Headlines.
Tēnā koutou, ko Eileen Aho. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has survived a vote of no confidence. Last night, New Zealand time, a vote of no confidence was issued against Conservative Prime Minister Boris Johnson, meaning that the 211 MPs in his party would vote as to whether they wanted him to stay as leader of the party and thus Prime Minister. 59% of MPs voted in Johnson's favour, with 41% voting for his removal. Johnson and his supporters within the Conservative Party are calling it a clear victory. However, those who voted against him, as well as opposition politicians, are still calling for Johnson to go. Technically, Johnson is now safe from being ousted for another year. However, former Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May stood down 6 months after only 37% of her MPs called for her removal in a vote of no confidence. The vote follows findings that Johnson broke COVID-19 lockdown laws that he had created after hosting a party at 10 Downing Street whilst restrictions were still in place, alongside concerns about his leadership abilities and popularity with the public. Close to one-third of nursing students are dropping out of their course before qualifying. According to RNZ, students say financial pressure, family responsibilities and other factors have all been worsened by COVID-19. The rates are higher for Māori and Pacifica nursing students, putting the push for a more diverse health workforce under pressure. The Prime Minister says work is underway to reduce the nursing shortage in the healthcare system, which she says is a global issue. Sky Television is in discussions to buy MediaWorks. MediaWorks owns around half of New Zealand's commercial radio stations and is a major advertising business. Sky Television shares have dropped over 7% since the announcement this morning. Sky will need approval from shareholders for the deal to go ahead. MediaWorks is currently majority owned by American firm Oaktree and has reported substantial losses in the last 2 years. And that was the headlines on the R1 News. Now, ke te pēhea te āhua o te rangi. How's the weather?
The R1 News weather.
I tēnei rā, expect a high of te Kauma ono, 16, and a low of Iwa, 9, in Otipoti, with northerlies easing in the evening and the chance of a shower. Āpōpō, a high of te Kaumāwhā, 14, and a low of Whitu, 7, is predicted, with northerlies and clear skies, save for the chance of an early morning shower.
That was the R1 News headlines. Catch up at r1.co.nz/news or find us at Radio 1 91 FM on Twitter or R1 News NZ on Instagram and tune in to R1 News at 11 a.m. on weekdays.
That was Eileen with the news headlines and weather for this cloudy Tuesday morning.
Now coming up on the show, we have our first live interview of the show, which is exciting because we have three of them today, so be sure to stick around. It's Nikki Page who will be joining us to talk about her book, The Heat Is On. But before that, we're going to play you a song just while we get in touch with Nikki. This is Kate Bush with Running Up That Hill, A Deal With God.
Yeah.
You've got it tuned to the Tuesday R1 News Show here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi Radio 1, 91 FM. The time is 12 minutes past 11. That song you just heard then was Running Up That Hill by Kate Bush, a great song recently revitalised by the hit Netflix TV show Stranger Things. This past Sunday, 5th of June, was World Environment Day, an annual event led by the United Nations Environment Programme to raise global awareness about the planet's degrading environmental conditions and to encourage people everywhere to take positive environmental actions to help create a better, more sustainable future. Quite appropriately, then, this past Sunday was when The Heat Is On, an illustrated journal of creative writing on the climate crisis, was released. Young writers from 20 different UNESCO cities of literature put forward their creative writing in the forms of songs, poems, and short stories to create a collection of work that centres on what many consider to be the biggest issue humankind has ever faced. With an introduction written by the Dunedin mayor, Aaron Hawkins, The Heat Is On was conceived and compiled by Dunedin's own UNESCO City of Literature director, Nikki Page. We are lucky enough to have Nikki joining us now. Let's bring her in. Kia ora, Nikki, are you there?
Morena Seb, I'm here. Thank you very much for having me.
Morena Nikki, thanks for being here. Firstly, I'd just like to say I think you have done an amazing job. Collecting all this amazing stuff from cities around the world can't be an easy thing to do. I mean, we've got works from Edinburgh, Jakarta, Granada, Reykjavik, just to name a few. What did the process of gathering all this together look like? And did it take a really, really long time?
It did take a long time, Seb. But it was really a fun thing to work on because it meant so much to us. And my lovely colleagues, Debbie and Anne, and I did spend probably the best part of the last year, once the idea was taking shape, liaising with all the different cities. And each city in turn had to work to find their contribution. So we wanted to allow plenty of time for each city to work with their wonderful young writer and put together their piece, and each piece is accompanied by a really beautiful image of their own choosing. So we didn't want to be rushing the cities, and especially during a difficult time around the world with the pandemic. So we allowed a good lead-in time, and also we were really, our heart was really in this project, and we wanted an outcome that we were all very proud of. So we did want to take our time, and it is a timeless publication, although, as you said, we launched on the 5th. It will always stand and obviously won't date. But I think in terms of the logistics, as you're asking, yes, there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. So the cities worked out their own contribution and how to remunerate their writers and who would be involved and finding a piece of artwork. And then we went back and forth and back and forth because we wanted to honour their first language. So we also had to make sure that we were transcribing the language accurately as well as the English translation. So, yes, a meticulous back and forth process around the different cities, you're right.
And what was the selection process within the cities for putting forward their writer?
Well, we left that to each city. That's a good question. We left that to each city. So we thought that some cities might like to run a competition. Some might have a writer who had already written a piece that they felt fitted, and it was written by someone under 20 and fitted perfectly in perhaps that already existed. And so, of course, permission would be sought. Some cities threw it open to a group of young writers. So, and some cities just had someone in mind. So really, each city, and you've listed some of them, they operate on such different sizes and in such different ways. We thought rather than be prescriptive, we'd leave it to each city to come up with the best solution to put someone forward. And our main concern was that the copyright would remain with that person and that they would be remunerated for their work. And then we would take on the very joyful task of celebrating their amazing writing far and wide in our collection.
You mentioned it just before, Nikki, but all the writers who contributed to The Heat Is On were under 20. To you, what was the significance of having young people participating in this project?
I think that was a key part of the project. I felt that it was the young voices we wanted to uplift and give a platform to, and also maybe even to connect with other young voices around the world. And that sort of strength in numbers, each piece individually, is really extraordinary. But then there's the collective power and impact of all those writers, and really wanted to offer a genuine platform on this issue, as you said, what could be more important. So to offer a genuine platform to the generation who is fighting so well for this but also so deeply affected by this, and to hand it over and let them take the lead. So a couple of cities pushed back and said, could we have someone a little bit older but really wanted to bring in new voices and hear the new voices on this particular subject. And so it felt like a really important part of this project that the writers are all fantastic new writers, and also they bring a raw and determined energy that I just don't think we would have been able to celebrate otherwise. So it makes a very strong collection, I think.
Yes, and there's such a cool global coordination, I guess, amongst, thanks to you largely, but amongst these young people, which the same can't necessarily be said for some world leaders in terms of, you know, this climate change is a global issue and it requires global solutions with a lot of discourse between, you know, nation states, which we don't seem to have this kind of concerted coordination among all the people that need to be involved, but this the heat is on is great because we see input from almost every nation around the world, which is awesome.
It does really feel exciting, doesn't it, to see all those different languages and cities and countries listed there. That makes me feel really thrilled too, because it's that feeling, as you said, of shared purpose and collaboration, and somehow it makes it seem so straightforward, doesn't it? I mean, it's such a no-brainer that this is a key for our planet, and there's so much complexity around the around politics, and so I know exactly what you mean. It's this clear, strong voice that comes through, so united across the world by the young people. I think it feels really great to me too.
And not only is it the writing of young creatives, but it's also artwork from these cities as well. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that's right. So the pieces are all creative writing, as you said. So they're not speeches or pieces of factual writing, which also would have been interesting. But our view was a creative response. How can we perhaps turn some of the tide of pull things along, and as you said, bring people along with us. By using the creative medium. And so, as you said, short stories and poems and pieces of writing that are creative. And then alongside that, we thought it would be lovely to have a striking image from each city. And in some ways, it's another way to exemplify the differences and yet the shared purpose between all the countries. And it's really amazing the way the cities have chosen to respond in terms of the creative writing and the image. They're so different and yet... as you said, shared. And so some cities chose to do a little sketch and others a full oil painting, for example, like Reykjavik in Iceland, and some a woodcut, Heidelberg in Germany, and others a beautiful little piece of found art in Jakarta made of outdoor findings like leaves and beautiful things arranged meticulously for the photograph. So everybody responded so differently, and I think that visual impact really lifts each piece too, because they were in response to the writing. So the piece of art was created in response to the young writer's work, and that in itself, I think they really speak to one another, and also it just makes it fun to look through too. There's so much going on. It's really fun to flick through, I hope you thought.
It is very fun to look through. And I guess for people just hearing about it for the first time now, can you help guide them as to where they can find this work? And also my question is, why will it ever be available in a physical form, something we can hold and look through all the beautiful pictures on lovely pages, or will it remain this digital anthology online?
Well, that's a lovely question, Seb. So, it's lovely to hear you say that, because it hasn't been planned as a physical book, but hearing you ask that, and if other people asked, maybe that would be something that we would look to do, because I think it would be a really beautiful artifact. And so thank you for asking. And if others express an interest in that, then perhaps that would be something I'd be really interested to look at. But currently the vision was for it to be a digital publication. That was largely so that we could make it free to everybody to enjoy, and also easily disseminated. So on World Environment Day, as you said, we all the cities were sharing it around their own social media, and also it was available to some delegates at a conference in Stockholm. So connecting with that day, and also UNESCO was able to share. So I guess there's that wonderful opportunity to share widely and make it available to as many people as possible in the digital format. But I also think to accompany that, it could be something really beautiful to hold. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. And so if anyone is interested, I hope that our listeners might like to have a look. That would be thrilling. And they can find that link on our City of Literature social media. So currently it's pinned to the top of our Facebook and also on our Twitter and our website. It's just a link to click on, freely available, and you're welcome to share the link. So I'd also like to mention our own beautiful entry from Ōtāpōti is a beautiful song, Huia Te Aroha by He Waka Kotuia, and they wrote that waiata as young people under 20, and also we're very lucky to include the video of that song. It's really beautiful, Huia Te Aroha, the stunning video shot partly at Otako Marae and also around in the environs, and beautiful, very catchy. In fact, I sometimes just have to listen to it before I start the day just to set me up for the day. It's really, really wonderful. So I'm so proud of that entry from Ōtāpōti and the fact that it was written in Te Reo and carries so much mana and beauty with it. And I know the other cities have really commented on that and really valued that contribution as well.
Yes, it's an awesome platform to experience such gorgeous cultures. Yeah, I'm sure, Nikki, you'll be flooded with expressions of interest to turn this into a physical copy. It's a stunning collection of work. I hope you're proud of yourself. You've done an amazing job. Thank you so much for joining us here on R1 News. It was a pleasure talking to you, Nikki.
Thank you so much, Seb. Thank you for inviting me and also those lovely comments. And please, any listeners are welcome to get in touch any time through our social media just to connect about our local writing and about the climate crisis or writing about anything. We'd love to hear from people. So thank you very much for engaging with us, Seb. I really appreciate it.
Lovely. No worries, Nikki. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Kia ora.
That was Nikki Page speaking to us about her new book, The Heat Is On. Now coming up on the show, we have our second live interview. This is going to be with Andrea Midgen, CEO of the SPCA, to talk to us about the government's underbudgeting of the SPCA. But before that, we're going to dive into a song. This is Big Small Town by local D. Stevens. You're listening to Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi 91 Radio 1 FM. Stay locked.
are tuned into R1 News here on Radio 1 91 FM. Just playing was Dee Stevens with his song Big Small Town. The time is 29 minutes past 11 and we are moving into our second live interview. On the 20th of May, the Royal New Zealand Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, also known as the SPCA, was denied its request for additional funding following the government's budget announcement. This comes as a disappointment to many animal welfare supporters, including SPCA Chief Executive Andrea Midgen, who says the lack of financial support for the government for a job which essentially sits within the Ministry of Primary Industries is a bitter pill to swallow. Joining us now is Andrea Midgen to talk us through this disappointing outcome.
Kia ora, Andrea. Are you there?
Kia ora.
Hi, thank you for joining us. Andrea, could you please elaborate a little bit further for the listener? What did the SPCA need to hear with this latest budget announcement? How far away are we now from the required government funding? And why do you think it is that the government is failing to properly recognise the vital role that the SPCA plays in animal welfare?
Absolutely. So it costs SPCA about $12.7 million a year, that's $12.7 million, to run this inspectorate service as a co-regulator with the Ministry of Primary Industries to deliver on the Animal Welfare Act. And the government currently gives us $2.5 million a year to provide that service. And like everyone across the country, you know, costs are only going up and it's just getting harder and harder for people, A, to support us to that sort of level, and also for us to be able to deliver the service across the country the way that we need to do it.
That's quite frustrating. So this huge gap in funding, that's being filled in by generous Kiwis?
But we're getting a shortfall in that we can't get enough donations to cover all the services we provide, because obviously we provide more than just inspectorate services. We also have got shelters that care for sick and vulnerable animals as well. And so it's really difficult. And I think to your last question was why. I think in the previous years, the government considered that the generous public have supported SPCA for the last 150 years and will continue to do so. But I think the landscape has changed, the whole environment's changed with COVID, and A, they can't support us as much as they used to, and B, with the rising costs, it's just becoming too challenging.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the tangible impacts that this lack of funding will have? What does it mean for the SPCA?
Well, we're just about to go into our approval process for our budget next year, which is looking very dire, and the horrible place that we may need to go if we don't get extra funding is that we will have to cut some of our service provision. And the difficulty with that is I'm used to being in that situation in corporate land, and you either turn off a product or a service and cut down your people, but if we do any of that, then animals are going to suffer across the country, and that's just unpalatable. And so we've got to come up with another solution.
If SPCA isn't holding neglectful pet owners to account and I guess housing all these animals in need, then who is? Is the SPCA the final frontier in animal welfare?
Yeah, we look after all the companion animals and livestock animals, whereas NPI looks after all the production animals, so the animals on farm. If worse comes to worse, then SPCA will have to say we just can't do this anymore, and then the government or the Ministry of Primary Industries will need to pick that work up.
So this is what can then be expected if there is no response from the government. And obviously the level of services that you would be able to provide would be damaged accordingly. Is there a way, though, that there can be an increased government support, or can the public do anything to help kind of rev up the government to give the funds needed to provide to the animals?
Oh, always. Government take notice of noisy public, if you like. So anything the public can do to make some noise would be most appreciated. I am working with the Ministry of Primary Industries with a proposal for funding. As I say, we didn't get anything in this budget, at least we haven't been advised of anything at this stage, so We are going to put a proposal to them following my board meeting next week.
Well, Andrea, thank you so much for talking to us. It is bitterly disappointing that the government hasn't been able to recognise all the amazing work that you do at the SPCA. And I'm sorry about that. We will do our best job here at R1 News to rattle up some support and some noise to make the government make some moves on this. But in the meantime, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I really appreciate that. Thank you. Have a good day.
Awesome.
You
see
too.
Andrea. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
That was Andrea Midgen speaking to us about the government's decision not to increase funds for the SPCA in its latest budget announcement. Now, coming up on the show, we have our first feature on another government budgeting announcement, this one regarding funding for the intersex community and the transgender community. But first up, here is Marlon Williams with his song My Boy. You're listening to R1 News.
This is the R1 News on Radio 1 91 FM. Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi.
On the topic of government funding in the latest budget announcement, the government has announced $2.2 million towards healthcare services for the transgender community. Additionally, $2.5 million of the 2022 budget will go towards supporting intersex children and youth. I got to speak to Ahi, the National Coordinator at Gender Minorities Aotearoa, on the government's proposed budget and plan and what it means for both the transgender community and intersex community, respectively. Gender Minorities Aotearoa is a national transgender organisation run by and for transgender people. They aim to facilitate health and well-being for transgender populations, including intersex and non-binary persons. Here's the interview. I am joined with the National Coordinator at Gender Minorities Aotearoa, Ahi. Thank you so much for joining me. So we are going to be talking about the government's new budget, which they've announced, which together I think is $4.7 million towards healthcare services for both transgender and intersex people. Individually, there is $2.2 million going towards the healthcare services for transgender people, and an additional $2.5 million will go towards supporting intersex children and youth. From my understanding, the main goal, I guess, of this budget overall is to continue to
reform the health system, whether that is physical health or mental health services, ensuring that the needs of those who have previously been excluded are accounted for and further included. Am I correct in assuming that?
Yeah, I think that sounds about right. I think that the government's recognised that there's a lot of health disparities for trans people and for intersex people, which are quite separate issues in a lot of ways for the purpose of health funding. In 2019, they took the cap off the genital reconstruction surgeries and they put funding towards that. So that's really great. And I think this is kind of the next step along that journey.
It's good that they keep on kind of recognizing that they need to further the services and further the discussion. And saying that for the transgender community, the services will go towards hormone therapy and work to support individual healthcare goals. And does this link to the work that you do yourself as part of Gender Minorities Aotearoa? Because I know that you provide heaps of services.
Yeah, I think that the plan for the trans part of the budget is to do intensive upskilling with 8 different clinics across the country. That it also includes, sort of tied into that, some like changes with PharmAct, with the way that some of the hormone medications are classified and funded, and some training programs and some guidelines for primary health. And I think like a huge part of what we do is advocating that trans people should be able to go to their local GP where they go for all of their other health needs and get, you know, hormones, because that's the main one that most trans people are really keen to get. But also that those doctors should know what's going on with their health and should be able to refer them on if they need any other kind of specialist treatment.
Definitely. And I guess building on from that, regarding the previous experiences of gender diverse people in the medical system, this funding does seem so important to further the understanding within the medical community of the needs, the specific requirements and needs of both, like, individually, because they are quite different and individualistic in needs, the intersex community and the transgender community. So to you, is that why the funding is so important to further the medical community's ability to support these communities and include them?
Yeah, I think there's some different elements. So I guess first I would say for the trans part that it's really important for clinicians to have both like sensitivity in how they work with patients and professionalism, and just, but it's important for them to medically understand what's happening for trans people and what they need. So it's kind of like having a better cultural understanding of trans people and also having a better medical understanding of what trans people need. Quite often, like a lot of the reasons why like hormone treatment in particular is delayed sometimes by 6 months or a year is because the clinicians don't necessarily understand what does and does not need to be done before someone can have hormones. So part of the intensive upskilling should will hopefully include training programs that can bring people up to speed on that stuff and guidelines for how to do that. A lot of the concepts behind how medications are provided are actually really simple. They, you know, they seem complicated if you haven't learned about them while you're at med school, which I think is one of the other things that, you know, one of the other parts of this kind of current plan is to change the expectation of trans healthcare being just part of healthcare. So hopefully, you know, ministries and ministers don't have a direct say in what gets taught in medical schools. But what, you know, if there is an expectation from the health ministers that, you know, med schools should be teaching about trans health, then hopefully that's something that we're going to see more of. I think with intersex people, a lot of the issues, it's still about having autonomy over your own health and having autonomy over your own body. But because it happens almost the opposite way around, where for trans people, it's usually that we are struggling to get healthcare procedures, whereas for intersex people, the issue is more often that, or the more pressing issue is that infants are being given medical procedures that they don't need, and that when they're older, they may regret, you know, they may not want to have had that happen to them. So it's a different kind of approach to being like, we need to make sure that whānau know, you know, we need to make sure that the healthcare providers and also the families know that actually it's okay if your baby's different, if your baby's born different.
That is a really good goal to have, of just reforming the medical community and starting off in medical school, making it just a part of the curriculum in general. In relation to that, what do you think are some of the barriers that have existed in the way of this progress? So do you think it's a bit of still a bit of transphobia in the community, or a lack of understanding in regards to the intersex community?
Yeah, I think that a lot of the time political change happens because it's what the people want. And that's how, you know, like that's how things change at government level when the people are like, we need this thing. And that is a strong enough and loud enough voice. Then eventually things, you know, things change. Sometimes things are led by the government, but most of the time the things that the government prioritizes to change are the things that, you know, that the people need on a big scale. But then also when there are small groups, like trans people are 50,000 people in New Zealand, so it's, you know, it's a relatively small group, it is harder to have your voice heard when you're a small population. And I think that's probably been part of why it's been so slow. I don't think it's explicit transphobia, but I think that, you know, it's about whose needs get put at the centre of change. And I think that hasn't been trans people for a long time. I think things are moving forward a lot faster now than they have been for a long time. And part of that is because there's just a lot more, it is a visibility issue. I think there's a lot more, you know, people in the wider public are like, oh, trans people exist. And maybe now people see us as human beings a lot more than maybe they used to. That very broadly, more people are like, oh, trans people are getting a bad deal and they should be able to get healthcare. So
a lot more discourse and just awareness around the two communities in general. And this just leads to my final question for you. With this budget announcement, do you think it has the potential to again create more positive influence on the social and political discourse surrounding these communities? Do you think that this is just hopefully another stepping stone to having further advocacy for these two groups in the medical community?
Yeah, I think the government recognising that trans people have really legitimate needs and should be looked after as part of the wider community is a really good, it's really good because a lot of people will see that and be like, oh, okay, cool. Government can take the lead on shaping, you know, how the public is thinking about different issues. So yeah, I think it's really positive to have the government saying, hey, trans people need healthcare too, and we're going to try and, you know, make sure that they've got it.
You got it tuned to the R1 News. You were just listening to Nico having a fascinating conversation with Ahi, the National Coordinator of Gender Minorities Aotearoa, on the funding for intersex youth and the transgender community. Now, coming up on the show, we have our favourite reoccurring segment. It's Creature of the Week with Andy Johnston. But first up, here's Lawrence Arabia with The Undesirables.
I'll let you go out. You can look after yourself. Just leave me.
This is the R1 News on Radio 1 91 FM. Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi.
Kia ora koutou, you're listening to the Tuesday R1 News here on Radio 1. That song you just heard then was Lawrence Arabia with his song The Undesirables. Oh, we've had a jam-packed show today, and it's about to get even more jam-packed because we've got Andrew Johnston, local zoologist in training, with us. Kia ora, Andy.
G'day, how are you?
We're good, man. How are you?
Very good. Very good. I'm very excited for today.
Today is...
The The creature?
The creature
today.
What is the creature?
It is, we're looking at bees.
Bees.
But a very interesting thing happened this week. Yeah. I'd like to start off with, yeah.
Yeah. I think I can lead into that from the article that you sent through. Why are four bee species legally considered as fish under the California Endangered Species Act?
I know.
That's so odd.
It's weird, eh? Yeah. Weird. So our favourite new fish is the bee, obviously. You know, we all think of a fish when we think of bees.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Really weird one. It's got a good ending. It's got a very good ending, but a very weird way to get there. So basically, California has this thing where they've got the California Endangered Species Act, right? And they've only got on this act, they can only protect so many different things. Okay, one of the things that they can protect is fish. They can also protect birds, mammals, amphibians, reptiles, or plants. But that doesn't really leave any space for insects, right? Mm-hmm. So what do you do? So a bunch of environmentalists campaigned. They said, hey, the way that you've defined fish is that you've said that fish, and the whole list, are invertebrates, right? So vertebrates is things that like don't have a backbone, basically. Yeah. So we're vertebrates as humans. You know, your dog, your cat, they're all vertebrates. And so they've classified fish as invertebrates. So these guys said, well, technically bees are invertebrates. So why don't we just, well, if fish are invertebrates and bees are invertebrates, then that means that bees are fish, which therefore means that we can therefore classify them under this Endangerment Act and get them protected.
Wow.
Which is a weird legal loophole, eh?
Yeah.
Super crazy. It reminds me a lot of New Zealand actually has something quite similar. Mm. Jacinta Rūru, who's a kind of a legal scholar, she was campaigning and successfully campaigned for getting Mount Taranaki and the Whanganui River legal personhood status.
Oh, yeah.
So they
have
all the rights of a person, mm-hmm, and can sue and can protect themselves legally. Mm-hmm. So it sounds pretty similar to that.
It does sound very similar, yeah.
Using these weird legal loopholes in your favor.
I'm all for it, you know? Mm-hmm. Anything to help these endangered animals.
Bees
are
fish.
Yeah. Bees are fish, why not?
I'm excited to start telling everyone that.
Yeah, go on
and
for it.
Sub-question.
Yes.
A fish?
Yeah, so something else that is kind of funny is that there's this guy, what's his name? Stephen Jay Gould, who spent his whole life studying fish, right? And the conclusion he came to at the end was that there is no such thing as a fish.
Doesn't exist.
No such thing as a fish.
Conspiracy.
Yeah, yeah. There's actually a podcast. It's based on the QI quiz show, if anyone knows about that. Anyway, they're called There's No Such Thing as a Fish. Basically, what he said was that he studied all these animals. There's a bunch of aquatic animals in the world, but they're hardly related to each other as much as any other genera or whatever would be related to each other. He said that the salmon is more closely related to the camel than it is to the hagfish.
What?
So if you kind of take that, then yeah, you think, yeah,
camel's
maybe...
Camel's a fish.
Yeah, maybe okay. Fish isn't really that good a biological definition. It's basically what it came to. Yeah.
Right.
So bees are fish and fish don't exist.
Wonderful.
And camel's a fish.
And camel's a fish.
Linking back to bees, though, who are also fish, as established.
Yes.
What about New Zealand bees or just bees in general? What can we know about them apart from that they're fish?
Oh, yeah. So when you think of bee, right, you think of your bumblebee, your honeybee, your buzzy bee going around making its honey, whatnot. But the native bee in New Zealand is actually quite different. And during my research, I was kind of astounded by how different it really is. So native bees are generally a lot smaller and kind of all black in color. So, you know, you think of bee, you think of the yellow stripes and whatnot. But they're tiny and they don't live in hives to begin with. They actually live underground. So they dig into the ground and that's where they lay their eggs. And they haven't got huge swarms or anything either. Big hive thing. Yeah. They just have like one female go down and lay the eggs. And then they'll have a few worker females, like one queen rather. And then they'll have a few worker females that go out and get the pollen and nectar and whatnot. And then the males are really just the drones. They're only really there for reproduction. So
right. The
males are pretty useless in the bee world. They don't really do much except reproduce.
In the human world, man.
Yeah. Yeah, because there's obviously this amazing thing in the world of bees, I guess, where they have the queen that takes control of everything, and then all the females are the worker bees. So you go out into nature and you see all the bees on the flowers and whatnot, they're all going to be female. So native bees are in the ground, and as far as I can tell, don't make honey. Which I'm here to be corrected. If anyone wants to call in and tell me that they can find a source that they do.
I think you're right.
I can't find anywhere.
Which, to me, doesn't meet the definition of a bee.
No, yeah, right? They're so, intrinsically linked.
That's really interesting. And it brings up a whole other kind of point of conversation about bees, which is honey, and which has given them some kind of social value.
We
love honey, and we therefore love bees.
Yes.
There are other more important reasons to love bees, maybe, in the sense that they pollinate most of the world's plants.
Yeah, big time, big time. Huge, huge. Like, pollination is so important for all of us. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I found a stat online that said that bees are responsible for pollinating approximately one-third of the food we eat.
Wow. Yeah.
So everything I see is like every third mouthful you eat is thanks to a bee.
Yeah.
Right? How crazy. And 90% of our fruit trees.
Crazy.
What? That's like all of our food. Yeah. It's so important. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if anyone's seen Bee Movie, the great Jerry Seinfeld classic, they'll know the consequences of bees going out of business.
It was actually a documentary, didn't it?
It was like
a future documentary.
Which is really interesting. Bee Movie, I was actually doing some reading. Mm. Fox Mayer from Critic actually did a Critic article about Save the Bees being a psychological operation to make us love bees, when really there are other pollinators we should focus slightly more on.
Sure, yeah.
I'm not sure if this is something you necessarily brought to talk about, but I think it's quite interesting because
it is, yeah.
We have a lot of love for these European bees that have essentially colonized this native space and have started kind of affecting some native bee populations quite severely, but we love them because we love our honey.
Exactly. There's like you say, there are other insect species that do pollinate, and even I think you can find online, I'll have to come back to this, but there are some like birds that do some pollination as well and stuff. It's not limited to bees, but bees are definitely the best ones at it, to my knowledge. But yeah, there is a lot of competition, right, between sort of the European honeybees and our native bees. So when you have your Manuka honey or whatnot from the supermarket, they're all made from Manuka plants but by European honeybees, right?
Yeah.
And so they're good at pollinating that and using that pollen. And they are good pollinators in New Zealand, but native bees are specifically designed for a lot of our native species. So our Kanuka, our Manuka, Putukawa, you know, all those kind of things are very native bees are kind of designed almost for these plants.
They evolved alongside each other.
So they both have their good and their bad, but you know, like any introduced species, there's always going to be a bit of conflict between the native and the introduced.
Mm.
So there is a bit of a worry there about the competition, which could lead to some issues with the native bees.
Yes.
So yeah, we got to look out for all of our bees.
We do. No bee is necessarily more, but all bees matter.
All bees, yeah, yeah, and exactly.
How can we help native bees, perhaps specifically, as to make sure that their population doesn't dwindle in comparison to the
big time. So native bees are actually quite interesting. Is that they only they don't go out and forage as far as a regular bee would. So you know, your honeybee will go off for ages to try and find flowers and whatnot, but your native bee kind of sticks in like a, I think it was like a 100 meter radius or something, or maybe it's smaller than that. I have to double check. So in your area, best thing to do is just plant wildflowers, plants, native flowers, native bush, native stuff like that, so that they can work on those. And then also another thing which is just good for all pollinators and for everything is just to buy seasonally, you know, because if you buy seasonally, that's where all, you know, getting in like the native the foreign bees to do all the work and whatnot as well. So there's two kind of things that you can work on if you want.
Support our local bee workforce.
Yeah
There's also an amazing way that bees communicate, is there not?
Oh my gosh, yeah. Oh, I love this. It's so cool. Yeah, yeah. You might have heard the waggle dance.
The waggle dance.
It just has an amazing name to begin with, right? I remember learning about this in primary school or high school or something, and it's just fantastic. It's just a cool. So anyway, what it does basically is that bees will often communicate through a dance, the waggle dance. And I've tried to break it down here as best as I could.
Okay.
But to basically say that they do a figure of eight dance, okay? And the duration of the dance is roughly the distance to where the flowers are or whatnot, because they're trying to communicate where the flower and the pollen is. How vigorous the dance is the amount of pollen that is at the at the location.
Dance.
Yeah, yeah. And then the angle that they're doing the dance to the sun, it kind of represents the angle at which these bees will have to fly
to get to
the pollen.
That is ridiculous.
So yeah, they kind of do this amazing little cha-cha to let you know where the honey is, where the pollen is.
And they're born with this knowledge.
Yeah.
They just somehow, this hive and mind,
mm-hmm.
intelligence has
this
been
like this innate ability, right? I there's a lot of things in nature where we don't fully understand what it is, but yeah. You know, hopefully one day, maybe you listener should go out and research it and yes. find out.
No, thanks for turning us on to these beloved little fuzzy creatures.
Of course.
Once a lot of people were afraid of them as just being nothing but a stinger, but after B-Movie and after Andrew Johnson came with Creature of the Week on Just Say Radio 1 News, no one was scared of bees anymore.
Not anymore. And native bees don't really sting very often either. So
and I guess the crux of this is without bees, we don't have
a lot of our food, we don't have a lot of our plants.
We don't have people.
We don't have a lot of nature. Yeah. Exactly. So look after your bees.
Look after your bees. All right, that brings us to the end of the Tuesday R1 News Show. That was Creature of the Week with Andrew Johnson. We were talking about bees. Before that, we had Nico with her pre-recorded interview.
I spoke to Ahi, the National Coordinator of Gender Minorities Aotearoa, on the government budget announcement to cater to healthcare facilities for intersex youth and the transgender community.
And prior to that, we spoke to the Chief Executive of SPCA, Andrea Midgen. We talked about the unfortunate underfunding of the Animal Welfare Association and the implications of this underfunding. And then prior to that, we got to talk to Nikki Page, the Dunedin City of Literature Director, about a book she has compiled containing international creative writing on the climate crisis called The Heat Is On, which you will be able to find on the R1 News socials. But yeah, that's about everything.
Thank you for joining us, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. And we'll see you next week.
See you next week, everyone. Have a lovely rest of your Tuesday. We're going to leave you with Hardy and Claire, Dunedin Band. This is their song, Mannequins. Thank you, everyone, for joining. We'll see you next week. Bye. I'm
Thanks for listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. There are heaps more at r1.co.nz.